Okay. So here we are today. It's Saturday, March 26th. In Hamilton, Montana, with Christy and Joff Fitzgerald. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I guess we'll start off today by having you both just state clearly your name.
Okay. My name's Jeff Fitzgerald, or Jeffrey William Fitzgerald. It's my full name.
My full name is Christy D. Cacciarella Fitzgerald.
So when and where were you born, Jeff?
I was born in Littleton, Colorado, 1969.
And Christy, where were you born?
I was born in Billings, Montana, 1970.
Okay. And Jeff, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Helena. My folks moved up to Helena from Littleton in 1972. And I graduated high school there.
Okay. And Christy?
I grew up mostly in Missoula, Montana. We moved, after Billings, we moved to Spokane for a few years and then over to Missoula and always ended up back in Missoula. So, and I graduated from high school in Missoula.
So I know in talking to you, Jeff, for the pre-interview, you guys have lived quite a few places. And Christy, you've told me just even as a young person, you moved around quite a bit. So if you could give me the kind of brief history of some of the places that you've lived, just
okay.
Pretty much a rundown.
Yeah, we turned into, kind of became nomads after college, but I had gotten my degree in fish and wildlife management and was desperately trying to get permanent work with either fish or wildlife, so I took a lot of seasonal positions, and I lived in Bozeman, but then moved to Creston, Montana, up by Kalispell, and lived there doing fisheries work for basically a summer. And then the office, the agency I was working for, moved to Lewistown. So then I moved to Lewistown, and I was there for about a year, and moved back to Bozeman. And then I moved to Nampa, Idaho, to do whirling disease research in fisheries, and was there for about 7 months. Moved back to Bozeman and stayed there for probably another 4 years. And then we eventually moved to Oregon, and I took a job doing spotted owl research in the Mount Hood Forest and lived actually in the woods for a year and a half. There was no town. It was just an abandoned ranger station. And then we moved to Redmond. Christy, when we were doing the spotted owl work, Christy got into graduate school and moved to Eugene. And then she finished that up, and then we both moved to Redmond.
Crooked River Ranch.
Yeah, the Crooked River Ranch. And then from there we moved to Culver, and then stayed there for about a year, and then we moved to Madras. And we were there for about
6 months.
6 months. And then we moved on to the Warm Springs Indian Reservation, where I worked for about a month because I got a job in Hamilton that I wasn't expecting. And then we moved to Hamilton. And here we've been for 5 years, the longest.
And so you have a job with?
Right now I work with GlaxoSmithKline in Hamilton, which is not part of my career, but we really wanted just to get back to Montana. So I was applying for anything and everything to get back.
Mm-hmm. And they're a pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, they're a biopharmaceutical company. And so I do, you know, the fish stuff on the side.
Mm-hmm. So. And you came over and also worked for them.
Right, I got a position with GlaxoSmithKline about a month after he did and worked there for about 4.5 years, and was laid off in June, and now I write. I'm having an article published, and I'm writing a novel. So,
oh, but now Where's your article being published?
It's going to be published in Renaissance magazine, and it's about Renaissance costumes for Renaissance fairs.
So you're married.
Mm-hmm. Been married since August 15th, 1992.
Okay. And how did you guys meet?
It's kind of interesting. I was in college. My sophomore year, I was living with seven other guys.
Well, we met your freshman year when you were in the dorms. My sister was going to college at Montana State University in Bozeman, and she asked me to come down for the weekend. She asked me to come down for spring break, because our spring break somehow coincided. And so I went down there, and she was friends with several guys that lived on Jeff's floor in the dorms. And so that's how we met, and we kind of became friends.
Right.
But I started dating one of the guys that lived on that floor who went to high school with us. And eventually, the next year, they all moved into the same house out in town. And when that guy and I broke up, Jeff and I started dating.
Which made it very uncomfortable. Yeah. For about a year.
Yeah. So he moved out fairly quickly after that.
Oh, that's funny. Mm-hmm. So you both, you have Irish ancestry, and you're mm-hmm. pretty certain that there's either Scottish or Irish
correct.
Ancestry yep. there. And do you have children?
No children.
No. Okay. So I'm going to ask you, Jeff, do you know when your ancestors left Ireland?
Yeah, we have a pretty good idea that my great-great-great-grandfather, David Fitzgerald, left Ireland, and I think he was on Island of Valentia, and we're not sure of the exact year that he left, but we know that he came over at the age of 17 on a coffin ship to America.
And so it was before 1860.
Yeah, he died in 1863. Mm. So, but we're not sure of his birth or where exactly he came from, but we do know that he did come through Ellis Island at 17.
Wow.
So.
And, so you're not quite certain exactly what he did or what the family may have done in Ireland.
That's kind of information that's lost.
That becomes kind of muddled when you get to that point in ancestry, because there's so many people that have the same first names.
Right.
Yeah, everybody was named Maurice, it seemed like, that we found. So we do know his name was David, and that's kind of where... That's kind of the wall we've hit so far, but mm-hmm. we're continuing and trying to figure it out.
Okay. And I'm just going to ask you both, and you're not certain of where your ancestry is.
No, I only know that his last name was McMillan, and he was my father's father. Mm-hmm. So, and I do know that from what I looked in Ancestry.com, there were several McMillans living in the Missoula area at the time. So, mm-hmm. but pinpointing which one it is was really difficult without knowing any more information.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to ask you both this question and just give it a little thought and tell me, what does your Irish ancestry mean to you?
Well, I don't think it meant much to me until after college, because in growing up, there wasn't anything traditional Irish that was celebrated. And it was just kind of the name. And so after college, I don't know, you just kind of have you're drawn to the Celtic knots and the Irish history. And that's kind of what sucked me in. And the other side of my family is Norwegian. And I'm almost half Norwegian, I am half Norwegian, and so there was a lot more tradition there, with my mom's side of the family. But my dad's side was frowned upon by the family.
Your grandpa was embarrassed.
Yeah, my grandfather was embarrassed to be Irish, and when my dad married my mother, my grandfather wanted to make sure it was okay for my dad, an Irishman, to marry into a Norwegian family. And he was really nervous if that was okay or not, which explains why there wasn't any traditional, or there wasn't anything Irish in our family.
And Brooks didn't talk about his Irish heritage, or did he talk about his brothers and sisters, which we didn't know about until we started looking through Ancestry, because it seemed like he wanted to distance himself from his family.
Yeah, so I learned very little about the family until probably the last decade, where I've been kind of pursuing it more. And I am really proud to be Irish, and because there's a lot of people that aren't Irish that want to be, yeah. It's like they're sort getting...
Plus it explains a lot about his personality.
I can have a pretty bad temper at times. It's short-lived, but ugly. So it takes a lot to get me upset.
And you're sure that's not the Norwegian, right?
Well,
it's a combination.
Yeah, it's the combination. But so yeah, I'm really proud of it, and
it's kind of interesting. How did your dad feel? I mean, was he just kind of not interested or didn't care?
He was really similar to his dad, where he doesn't care so much about the history or the family, you know, the family ancestry, things like that.
He's got kind of an indifferent personality.
Yeah, it's not that he doesn't like it or likes it. He's just kind of middle
doesn't
of the road.
Care. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's...
Although, you know, he did send us this information once he knew we were looking for it, so obviously he was thinking.
Okay. Yeah, it's like I've been looking into the family history for years, and then finally when I mentioned that we were going to have this interview, all of a sudden I get a family tree and a letter and all this stuff where I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, where's this been? And I didn't even know this existed until 2 days ago.
Wow.
I've never seen a family tree for the Fitzgerald side of the family until 2 days ago.
Wow. So they had the Fitzgerald men had tempers too, and so their family lives were, the men haven't traditionally gotten along that well. And plus his grandfather's father remarried a woman who was much younger than he was, and it was both of their second, wasn't it both of their second marriage? Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of that had to do with not passing on a lot of that information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of taboo and, you know, secrets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
more typical family stuff,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It exists in every family.
Oh yeah.
You know. Yeah. Well, what a treasure to get that now. You know.
Yeah.
To be able to have that and have it go to the hands of somebody who is proud to have it.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really nice.
So, Christy, what about you? When you think about it.
The interesting thing for me is when I found out my true heritages, it suddenly felt like it fit. Because I grew up in a family where we thought my heritage was Italian, but I never felt like that fit for me. I always felt kind of weird about it. I didn't like Italian food. You know, my mother kept saying, "What is wrong with you?" And although I love, my grandfather was the most important thing to me, and he's Italian. And they found, he did his family history, and we had all kinds of information. But then when I found out that I was either Scottish or Irish, it felt like it totally fit because I've always loved like Celtic music. That's why we both were, when we found it out, it was so amazing because of the fish and wildlife and outdoor aspect that Jeff has. He's so in tune with the nature, you know, and that's, you know, the Druid religion with the Celtics and stuff that has to do with nature and being close to nature. We both have felt like when we lived in the forest in Oregon was one of the best times of both of our lives because we were so close to nature. And when you find out that you belong to a heritage that, or a nationality that has the beliefs that you had before you found out, it's just amazing. And plus, you know, I've been writing since I was, you know, in middle school, and you know, I was using the Celtic language for the characters that I had. And I have Celtic dictionaries, and I have online translators and stuff, and so the language that they spoke was always Celtic, and it was just, to me, it was amazing to find that out, because for me it was by marriage until I found out all of a sudden I am either Irish or Scottish, and I was really happy because We started going to Renaissance fairs, and we started listening to Celtic music and going to, you know, seeing Celtic women, and just, you know, it was just this kind of coming together, I think, for us, mm-hmm. of, okay, that fits, that's why this makes so much sense. So,
do you have any stories of how your family first came to the United States? You just know that he came through Ellis Island.
One interesting story that's come down the line is that historically Fitzgerald always had a capital G, and I think over the centuries it kind of was lost or something, and when David Fitzgerald came over, he had a lowercase G. And the story is that when he got to America, he was absolutely broke. Like everybody probably that came to America at that time was absolutely broke. And so, being a strong Catholic, he went to the Catholic Church for help, and they refused him help. And so he was basically living on the streets, barely surviving, and he kept going back to the church, you know, for food or shelter or something, you know, something to keep him going, and they kept refusing. And the reason why they refused, we don't know, but in order to, I guess, get back at them, he capitalized the G. And at that time, according to our story anyway, that was to change your name with the church was taboo. And
excommunicated.
So they excommunicated him, which was fine with him, because he was so upset. And so he capitalized the G, and then he was recapitalizing the G, and that's
and the translation from, because Fitzgerald actually in Irish is Mac Geralt, and that translates as son of Gerald, but yeah. Capitalizing the G.
So capitalizing the G changed the translation to bastard son of Gerald.
So that's why it was his way of flipping the church off, basically.
Right.
Wow, very interesting.
And so he ended up, it's kind of muddled a little bit, but he ended up owning a business in New Jersey and then joined the Union Army Civil War he joined in 1862, and he had a wife and children, and then he ended up dying he served under General Sherman, and he ended up dying of disease in 1863, and his son Maurice was only just born, and so Maurice never knew his father, and so that was Maurice would have been my great-great-grandfather. And Maurice was always, for his entire life, was very upset with the U.S. government, because when David died, the government didn't take care of David's family. And because it was a wife, and he left a wife and three kids behind, and they were in deep poverty because he left a good business to help his country, and then the government didn't take care of the veterans' families. And so Maurice was always angry. His entire life held a grudge against the U.S. government because they don't take care of the families. Mm-hmm. And it seems like times haven't changed, because veterans now mm-hmm. are still struggling with getting help from the government. Right. And it's so sad.
Yeah.
And so...
Did Maurice's mother remarry? Do you know any of those stories?
I don't think so. Let me look at our family tree. I just got this, so I'm still trying to learn it. But, no, because David was married to a woman named Elizabeth Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And it states a letter that I received from Harold, my great-grandfather. I don't think that Elizabeth ever remarried. So it doesn't show that she had remarried on here. So I'm not sure how they, you know, the story of how they survived that time mm-hmm. is still kind of a mystery right now. Mm-hmm. So.
And you have a letter?
Yeah.
And would you mind reading this letter?
Can you read it?
I can...
He's got very florally handwriting. It was Harold Belden Fitzgerald, his great-grandfather wrote it.
Yeah, I can read it. I don't mind reading it.
I'd love for you to read it.
And, yeah, some of the words I can't figure out, so just bear with me. So this is a letter that was written to my mom and dad, Gail and Bill, from my great-grandfather, Harold Belden Fitzgerald. And this is July 12th, 1971. And it's from Glenridge, New Jersey. So he writes, "Assuming that you have now returned to Denver, it is time to prepare the sheet of family tree lines and names that has been partly worked out. It could be better, but I don't seem to be smart enough to do it. This is the fourth draft I made. There is a lot about my father's family that I do not know. The reason is that he enlisted in the Northern Army during the rebellion in or about 1862, when my father was just born. My father never saw his own father because he died in Athens, Georgia, of disease in the army of General Sherman." This sentence, there's two words, I don't know what they are. It says, "My grandfather was a something in a regiment."
It's a strange word.
It looks like a...
Gawain or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's like Gawain or Zwain or... Yeah, it's like was a Gawain in the Gawain regiment, perhaps. He left a good business to enlist. His family of a mother and two brothers and one sister were in dire poverty because of his loss. My father never forgave the U.S. government for not taking more care of the dead veterans' families. My mother's father was a Baptist. My mother's father was a Baptist preacher in the northern New York state country, mostly... not sure this word. It's mostly something in Indians in his time. I'm not sure what that word is. He died in 1877 and is buried in a small cemetery at Putnam, New York. Bill's father has a snapshot of his gravestone. My mother, at the time of his death, was only 13 years old and lived in Putnam. The railroad from Albany to Canada was just being built along Lake Champlain at that time. Her sisters, all older, took care of her. Her sister Emma married a rich man from Vermont and took her to New York City, where she met my father about 1887, plus or minus a few years. As you see... Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, as you see, as my mother's mother was dead when she was a baby, could not get much family history and tell me from them. The same for my father. The tracing paper can be reproduced maybe by Bill at his office or otherwise in Denver where they have blue printing machines. If you have questions, mail me a copy with notes for me to expand upon it, and I can. Love from us both to you all, Grandfather Fitzgerald." So he has one giant P.S. that he maybe forgot to write. P.S. Regarding the Fitzgerald name, the Fitz is the only Irish part and means something son of. I can't read that word there. What's that? Not sure. The Gerald part is Norman French. The Geraldine came from Perche, France. The Geraldines were mercenary soldier tribes, and so it is said goes back in history to Italy, where their name was Gerardi. There are books on the Fitzgerald name which you can buy. I don't have any to send you. My father's father was born on the island of Valencia off the southern coast of Ireland. My father was born in New York City at the site of New York, at the New York end of Brooklyn Bridge, which in 1862 had not been started. My mother was born in a place called Burlington Flats in New York State, which I have never been able to find. This was in Lake Champlain, around which my grandfather once preached. Harold Belden Fitzgerald, 1971.
You should tell her what you found out about the Girardis and all that.
So, well, based on the information on that, I went onto the computer last night and learned that the Girardis family originated in Florence, Italy. And they're either known as Girardi or Gherardini. Gherardini, and the Gherardini family had Mona Lisa was part of that family.
Mona Lisa Gherardini.
Yeah, was that family, and they were also as they moved to France, they are always in like the highest society. They were always royalty as they moved to France and then moved up to Ireland. Mm-hmm. So. Which is pretty interesting that mm-hmm. I should be royalty right
well,
now.
Yeah. One of
What's
the
going on?
It wasn't one of the Nesta Girardi marry or had an affair with Henry I.
Oh. Yeah, the Walter Fitzgerald married Nesta, Queen
but
Nesta.
She was a little bit of a flimsy. She was a princess.
Yeah, she was a princess, and so, but she. She started like the Tudor family of Henry,
oh my gosh.
The Henrys down to Henry
wow.
VIII. And so the Fitzgeralds, which I'm not sure if it's exactly my line, but are related to that, the Henry VIII, Henry family.
The Tudors.
Yeah, the Tudor family. Distant cousins.
Wow.
So we found out a lot of really interesting stuff just mm-hmm. yesterday.
Yeah.
Wow. And then how about you, Christy? Do you know any stories about how the McMillans, you really don't have any?
I don't know a lot. It was my grandmother's first, either first husband or, because she had two boys, my father and his older brother. And when my father was a year old, she married my grandfather, Tony Cacciarella, who was Italian. And my father was told his whole life that he was his dad. Even though my older uncle was probably 4 or 5 when that happened, so he, I would guess, maybe suspects at least that my grandfather's not his real father, but none of them talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to find information, but it's just been really difficult to find anything. And my aunt was actually the one, when I was looking for the family tree, the Italian family tree, who pulled me aside and said that I'm not Italian, and that I was that McMillan was the name, and that she didn't know anything else about it. And that when my uncle, my grandfather had 4 boys, 2 which weren't his. The oldest of his child, when he turned 18, he said, I just want you to know that you are my oldest heir. And so that's where that finally came out. So, but he didn't tell my dad. And so I'm the only one that at this point in my, you know, he told his wife, obviously, who told me. So we're really the only ones that know. And I don't get along with my parents that well, so I haven't said anything to him, and I doubt that he would share anything he knew with me, and I kind of doubt he would want me to find that information. However, my mother shared her information with me, and I was able to find all that, so
mm-hmm.
it's kind of that secretive family thing.
Mm-hmm. You'll have to just find another inroad.
Yeah, yeah. I hope not to give up.
Yeah. So, you talked a lot about you, especially Christy, about how your family did move around, and then are you the first to live in Montana? Then were you the first one over here? How
No.
did your family come here?
My grandfather Brooks, my dad's dad, he moved. They lived in New Jersey for a long time, and my dad was born in New Jersey. And then they moved to, I think they moved to Colorado, and he was working for an oil company in terms of advertising for an oil company. And I can't remember, it may have been like Amco, maybe, and
but
that's kind of...
Did that in New Jersey too.
Yeah, he did that in New Jersey, and he was a good salesman, and so they moved him. And so he came over to Colorado, and then eventually he moved up to Billings, Montana, and that was in probably in the 50s. And
changed his career.
Yeah, he did. He changed his career and got into graphic design work, sign work, and he stayed living up in Billings, and he had two more sons. My dad's got two brothers. Bob is only a couple of years younger, and then Paul was quite a bit younger, like 15 years or so. And Paul was born in Billings. And then my dad, he went to school at the U of M in Missoula, ended up taking a job, moving to Colorado. He and my mom married, and my sister and I were born in Colorado, and then we all just moved back to Montana. So my sister's lived her whole life in Montana. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up coming back.
And how old were you when you came back here?
I was 36, right?
You mean when he was a baby?
Yeah. Oh, or no.
You were like
when
two,
I came back from,
you?
Yeah. Yeah, when we moved from Colorado to Montana, I was three.
Three.
It was 1972. And then I moved away in 2001 to Oregon and then came
back in
2006.
Okay.
Yeah, 2006.
Okay. And so, Christy, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what you remember about Missoula growing up.
You know, growing up in the Italian heritage, that was like he was talking about his Norwegian traditions. That was the tradition that we went by. We had a lot of Italian family that there were people that I would call like my grandmother, and it turns out she wasn't my real grandmother, which I didn't find out until she died, actually. But we went to church regularly at St. Francis, and when I was little, as we were talking about, the weather was a lot different. Winters were longer and harder. I remember school closing, which never happens anymore because, you know, back then you might get 6 feet of snow or more, and you couldn't go anywhere. You know, the buses couldn't go anywhere. We moved to Oregon and Washington a couple times because my dad was a salesman. He spent most of his time as a salesman. Like, he sold chemicals. He sold sewing machines for a long time. He sold jewelry. And so he might end up getting transferred to, like, Kennewick, Washington for 6 months as a training or something. But we always ended up back in Missoula, but we moved around a lot in Missoula, which was kind of strange. But, you know, I saw a lot of subdivisions go up, you know, out back then, like Reserve Street, which is now its own community, had nothing but a Senex gas station. We'd go go-kart riding at a little go-kart track that you can kind of still see the overgrown track, but it's now beneath the an exit. And back then, there wasn't anything like that there. We'd go go-kart riding out there on Sundays. And, you know, my mother lost a baby before I have an older sister, and so before her was a boy. And so we'd go out to the cemetery out there and put flowers on his grave, and there was nothing out there but the cemetery. And now there's so many houses out there along the highway now. It's amazing. There was nothing out there either. When I was in high school, we moved up on Hillview, which there's some older houses off of Whitaker. That's what we called that kind of subdivision up there. And we had built a house there when I was in junior high, and there was nothing over to on the other hill. And when I was in high school, we bought a house up there, and we would ride our bikes up there, and there were empty cul-de-sacs. There were all these empty cul-de-sacs where there were no houses built. And if you go there now, there was right by my house, there was this huge like gully, and they filled it in because there's all these developments, like all these subdivisions there. Because when I couldn't believe that they had houses built there, because I remember it was a gully. And so it just amazes me, not only how many housing developments there are now, but the traffic. You know, we had Malfunction Junction, which was not how it is now, and you could sit there waiting for 15 minutes through a light, you know. And we would cruise there when I was in high school. We would cruise through Malfunction Junction, or we would cruise the drag, we called it, which was downtown. And now even that's different because they built the carousel there. They have that Brendan's Wave. None of that existed. It was just, it was very industrial downtown. There wasn't a lot of shops down there. And it just really amazes me, the traffic situation and how they didn't plan for it when they started the town, and how much more traffic there is now and how much more everything. It's just different. But I'm not intimidated to drive there. Mm-hmm. It's just different. Mm-hmm. It's grown a lot.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. So are there any traditional first names or nicknames in your family that have been passed down?
Yeah, there's, seemed like, let me think. So my name is Jeffrey William. My dad's name is William Brooks. His dad is
Maurice
Brooks. And then Maurice, as far as I know, he's just Maurice Fitzgerald, and then there's David. And so it seemed like there was a reoccurring name coming down the line. Although David and Maurice, I don't know if they had middle names or not. It hasn't been recorded. So
mm-hmm. They were passing, it seemed like they were passing on one of the names of the previous generation to the sons.
Yeah, and Harold, my grandfather, Harold, oh, I skipped Harold. So my grandfather is Maurice Brooks, and then Harold, his dad, is Harold Belden. And Maurice had married a woman, what was her
Nellie?
Name?
No, Harold's wife is
her. Let's see. Yeah, so Maurice had married Nellie Belden. And so Harold's middle name was Nellie's last name, maiden name. So, but I guess everybody called him HB. He wasn't Harold very often. He was HB.
HB.
Right. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
And any other nicknames in your families?
Not that I know of.
No, they always called us Koch.
And your father's first name was?
Dennis.
Dennis.
And what he did, when my sister was born, they wanted to pass on his name somehow, and they named her Dana, but they did that because they wanted the D. And my dad's middle name is Alan, and they gave her middle name Elaine. Hmm. And in fact, in my family, this is really yucky though, they name a lot of the girls after their fathers, but it's not like names that you would normally name a girl. So my grandfather's name was Martin, and his daughter's Martina. My uncle's name is Leo, his daughter's Leola. My uncle's name was Richard. His daughter's name is Dickie Joe. So that's what they did. That's how my family did it.
Hoping for boys, got girls, made the best of it.
In fact, my mother's nickname is Chuck, because they wanted a boy, and that's what they were going to name the boy. And so everyone calls her Chuck instead of Joey.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So, what was, What kind of housing did you grow up in? What neighborhood and.
We grew up in like middle class. I guess in the, I don't remember the days in Littleton at all, but I guess it was just kind of your basic middle class. It wasn't poverty. My dad he's very smart. He got a good neighborhood in Denver because his first job out of college was. He programmed the computer for the first satellite that NASA put into space. So right out of college, that was his job, and so paid really well. Wasn't wealthy, but lived in a good neighborhood, and he didn't want his kids growing up in Denver, and so they moved to Helena. And we lived in...
And that's Helena, Colorado.
Helena Montana.
Oh, Helena, Montana.
Yeah. Helena, Montana.
Which is where they still live.
And so it was a huge pay cut, but it was worth it to keep my sister and I growing up in, Metropolis, because Denver was enormous then. And so he didn't want that. He grew up, spent a lot of his life in Montana, so that's what he wanted for his kids, and which, thank God.
Now, tell me again, how many siblings do you have?
I have one sister. She's 2 years older.
Okay.
Yeah, and she lives up in Missoula.
Okay. And Christy, you moved around a lot. Your dad was a salesman.
He was a salesman. My parents, they
They lived, we were pretty much middle class, although my dad worked really hard his whole life. I think he wanted to be an art teacher at one time. He was artistic, but I just remember he worked so hard I didn't see him very much because he wanted us to live in that middle class lifestyle or higher if we could. So he worked more than 40-hour weeks. He was gone a lot. He wanted to work his way up to like management and then district management, and so that's partly why we moved a lot. But we were always in, you know, I think we started out when I was a baby in a trailer, and then we worked our way up from there until by the time I was in high school, we were living up in a really nice neighborhood, in a really nice house, and they now live in Liberty Lake, Washington, on a golf course in a nice house, and he finally retired, but he just worked so hard his whole life that, you know, I think that was part of the moving, was going from poverty up, you know, that he was, mm-hmm. but I think he worked too hard. I think that he was gone from his family a lot, and he worked really hard, and now he's, you know, mm-hmm. mad.
So did you guys all share chores, or did what was that like, living in the home? Did everybody have responsibility, or did the mom and dad take care of everything? Or?
No, and my folks they divorced when I was 7, and it was pretty ugly, and I think it was just that I was so young and didn't understand what was going on, but up until that point, I really don't remember too much, but then after that, I remember quite a bit, and my dad moved out, and my sister and I took care of, we did a lot of chores, and my mom would pay us an allowance of, it started out at $1 per week, and then after a few years, it moved up to like $5, and I thought, holy smokes.
That's a lot of money.
I'm raking it in now. So, but we did, my mom worked from 7 in the morning until after 5. She would get us up before she left for work. When I was starting in first grade, I would make my own lunch. I'd make my own breakfast. Sometimes I'd come home for lunch. I was close enough to walk to school, but then I'd get home at like 3:30, and she wouldn't get home until 5:30. And now people now kind of are shocked at it, but back then that was just the way it was. That my sister and I took care of ourselves between 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. basically every day. And so, and we would help with, it seemed like it was just like this innate feeling that she needed help, and we just would help. That was just the way it was, that we would just do that. And we learned to do the laundry, and I was mowing the lawn at 8. I couldn't, you know, it was a stretch to push the lawnmower. And I took jobs, too, to help bring in money. Like, I started mowing lawns and shoveling walks when I was, eight years old. And that was...
Did you do a newspaper, too?
I helped throw newspapers with some friends. And 7th grade, I was a garbage man for a trailer court. So it was just like I was always working. And and my dad, he instilled... you know, like this work ethic in me, that you only make money when you work. And so up at his house, he remarried when I was in 4th grade, and we did a lot of chores, a lot of household. My sister and I took care of the house up there, pretty much did all the chores. And his wife, it was tough growing up with a stepmother. She was a person that I don't think ever wanted kids. Mm-hmm. And so it was a difficult transition for her too. And it was just hard on all of us. And so
the big difference though was you guys felt like you wanted to help your mother and did a lot more, and she didn't really ask you. You did it anyway. But your dad made you guys do it, and she left you a list and told you how long each chore should take in minutes.
Right. It was
a big difference.
Yeah, it was like we didn't want to help her, but with my mom we did, and that, you know, it's just that mm-hmm. that motherly love thing, that separation. And so. And
so did your father live in Helena too then at mm-hmm. that time with yeah. his ex, with his new wife?
Yeah. And we kind of lucked out because they did both live in the same city and they are 3 miles apart. But divorce is hard on kids. And I, you know, I talk to people now that are in divorce that are my age, and I talk to them about their kids and what the kids are going through. And it is pretty tough, and it was really hard because my dad is, he was more strict of a person, and maybe the more Irish temper, and then my mom was more liberal, laid back, and so it was these two...
polar opposites.
Yeah, they're just two different households, and so the way that they worked out the arrangement for the kids, my sister and I, was 2 weeks at my dad's house and then 2 weeks at my mom's house year round. And so I had two sets of toys, two sets of friends, two sets of clothes. And so you move from one environment to the next and it's just like night and day switch every 2 weeks. And so it was my dad's like, well, your grandfather made me put half of all my money into the bank. And so that's what I ended up having to do too. And so I had to work more to get enough money where I thought I was making enough. So I did, I started working when I was 8, basically, from like mowing lawns and shoveling walks. And then I had friends at my dad's house that threw newspapers. So then I started helping them doing that. And then their dad got us a job at a trailer court picking up garbage. And so their dad would drive the garbage truck. And when you're like 6th and 7th grade, that's a fun job, is getting a ride on the back of a garbage truck and dumping, you know, all this crap into the garbage truck. And so we did that every Saturday for a couple summers. And we got a lawn mowing business going where, you know, for $15 we'd mow their lawn. And so we pick up garbage and mow lawns in the same trailer court. Mm-hmm. And in Helena, we rode our bikes everywhere. And so it was actually, I have a lot of really good memories because my dad lived, his house butted up against National Forest. Mm-hmm. And so we could go out and play in the woods, my friends that I had up there. And then when I go down to my mom's house, usually I missed my friends. And so I'd just ride my bike up and spend the day with them. And it was like 3 miles away. But we rode our bikes everywhere. Like one thing I remember doing it twice, and I can't imagine I did it, but... my friends, Craig and Jake, that lived up at by my dad's house, their dad was a miner. And so he was running heavy machinery at a sapphire mine near Canyon Ferry Lake. It was out on York Road, about 10 or 12 miles. And so we would go out with him at work in the morning and take our bikes. And this was like in grade school. This is like, we were probably 10 or 11. And then when we got bored up there, we'd just ride our bikes into town, back into town. So we're riding our bikes on a highway with no shoulder on BMX bikes for like 12 miles. And we didn't think anything of it. It was like, well, we want to go home. We better get going. So I always had, I have a really strong work ethic because that was the only way I was going to get any spending money was to...
Well, and when they split, it seemed like both of them kind of went down a notch financially.
Right, yeah. And and my mom struggled. She, you know, was a bus driver, and she was a special education teacher, and that's what she retired as just last year. So she really struggled, and so the jobs I took in high school, I made sure to get, you know, 30 or 35 hours a week so that I could help, you know, buy some groceries and things like that.
And are you still in touch with any of those friends?
Not so much. We kind of fell apart in high school, and I'm just amazed at some of my friends now that still have friends from grade school. That never happened with me. And
but his mother is an she knows everybody, and she remembers everybody. And so she'll call him up and say, oh, you know, this is what Craig and Jake are doing now. I talked to their mom. This is what she's doing. And she'll just, or send him an email. Mostly she calls and she says, this is what so-and-so is doing. So-and-so is married this person. This is their new job. They moved here. Their mother has cancer. It's like anytime you talk to her on the phone, she goes on for 20 minutes about his old gym teacher and what happened to him. And, you know, it's just amazing.
It's like an oral history every phone call.
Yeah. Pretty much is.
I'm like, I don't even remember I was friends with that person.
If you don't want to talk to her for longer than 45 minutes, then you don't answer the phone.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't keep in touch with any of those people anymore. So.
And what about religion? Did you grow up going to church?
No, we didn't. Even when my folks were married, they didn't do church at all. My dad's family was Methodist.
But you were baptized because you have that candle.
Yeah, I was baptized, Presbyterian, I think, which is on my mom's side. Mm-hmm. The Norwegians were Presbyterians.
Yeah, because your grandmother was very religious.
Yeah, she was. So, yeah, it never trickled down. There was no religion. I only went to church for weddings and funerals type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about religion or God or anything like that growing up. I just never, and still, I mean, to the day, I don't have a religion myself.
He always says there's fishing gods.
Yeah, there are fishing gods. And that's the only religion.
And skiing gods.
Right, yeah.
So, Christy, you mentioned going to the Catholic Church.
Actually, interestingly, both my mom and dad's side of the family attended St. Francis. And, you know, when we were growing up, my mom tried to get us to take CDC classes so that we could get our first Holy Communion and all of that. And, we were kids, you know, we didn't want to, because that we had to do that before we went to school every morning. And so you had to get up extra early and, we just didn't want to do it. And so she finally let us, not do it. But we went to church every Sunday, but my dad was the kind of guy that he made us sit in one of the last three rows because he wanted to get out first. And so we'd be sitting all the way in the back and we could barely hear what was going on, let alone see the priest, because St. Francis is a huge Catholic church. And, but I did remember, you know, like my grandma Moroni, who was one of our many Italian relatives, she and my grandmother would go like on Wednesdays and Saturdays and Sundays, and they'd wear the lace, the little lace covering black one that you wear when you go to church. And, you know, my grandma Moroni, who she'd wear the black dress and the black, you know, and they had, and one of the things I really remember was my great-grandmother, who was my first best friend, because she lived with us until I was nine, and we shared bedrooms, and it was wonderful to me because I didn't like the dark and I didn't like being alone. And she carried around a crucifix all the time and her crucifix beads. And she was very religious, and she wore the lace too, and she attended the church, and she would, I just remember, and she had all these like Mary statues and Jesus statues and on her dresser, and I inherited some of those when she died, and I just thought it was really neat because of her, because I loved her so much, and she was so into it that she kind of got me into it. And then the same with like my grandma Roni and stuff. My grandfather didn't attend church, even though they all did, and eventually my parents kind of gave up doing the church thing. And when we moved away from Missoula, this is really weird, but I felt like I would be betraying St. Francis, because it's such a neat church, and it didn't feel like my religion was necessarily attached to it, but I never felt the same way about going into other Catholic churches, because St. Francis is a cathedral, basically. Mm-hmm. But I do feel religion internally, and so I don't talk about it a lot to people, but I do pray, and I still have family members who are very religious, mm-hmm. and, you know, they send me cards that are very religious, or, you know, little plaques and stuff, and that's fine. And but we have attended church together probably only a very small handful of times. My grandmother was, they you know, when she died, they did a thing on that Thursday night where you just sat in the church and said the Hail Mary over and over for an hour, and I've never gone to one of those before. But, you know, he went with me, and we've gone to church a small handful of times. And sometimes when I was in Missoula in between, because we lived in Bozeman, I would go light a candle for my grandfather. And so religion has not been something together that we've done, that we've never really, you know. The Druid thing, when the Irish thing came up, that was really cool, and we bought books about that, and we're reading about that. And I kind of still just do it myself. Kind of just, you know, I don't feel like I have to go to church.
Okay. Does your family have any special sayings or expressions?
Well, on my mom's side of the family, it's very Norwegian. They're like, oofta.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very common one. But on my dad's side, we didn't. On the Irish side, I don't know if we had any expressions. Everything was revolved around working hard. I don't know if there was an expression in there or not, but it was deeply ingrained that you work hard.
Mm-hmm. My dad came up with a ton of different things. He'd say things like, little weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. I mean, he just would say odd things that he would write down, and like, and the favorite number was always 37. Mm-hmm. For everything, every single thing. Yeah, I mean, there were just things that he said over and over and over that after a while you just kind of, or, you know, and again with the Italian thing, he used to have a shirt that said, I'm an Italian, wop, 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 and it was crossed out. Mm-hmm. But otherwise.
Yeah, I don't think we had anything.
And so when you celebrated holidays, then there was no, and the focus was more kind of on the Norwegian and the Italian for you. Mm-hmm. So there was not really anything Irish in those celebrations that you remember.
No, there was, the only one was St. Paddy's Day, and you wear green, and that was it. But that's what everybody did, mm-hmm. so it wasn't special. Mm-hmm. And, there wasn't anything traditional in, for the Irish side. The Norwegian side was very heavily Norwegian, traditional foods, you know, traditional dress a lot of times, and... But yeah, it was much stronger than the Irish side. I mean, the Irish side was almost non-existent except for that the last name was Fitzgerald. I mean, mm-hmm. There wasn't any other recognition mm-hmm. besides that.
And so I see that you both are wearing Henri Ra.
Yeah, we've started attending, we started going to Irish festivals, and we did go to Butte for St. Patrick's Day once, and then but now they have this Henri Ra celebration in Butte every year that we started attending and we go to every year now. And we went, you know, to the Irish Studies benefit and stuff, because mm-hmm. that stuff is we really like that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out how to ask this. What is it now that, I mean, I know that you said that you just kind of have this innate, you were drawn to this culture.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that that's so important to you now?
It's, I don't know what it is. I think it's, I guess what it is, it feels like I have this, as I've become a little bit, you know, when I started getting a little bit more interested in my family history and just basically going through life and meeting other people and stuff, there seems to be this big draw to being the people, like I said earlier, like people want to be Celtic, you know, they're like, gosh, I wish my family was Irish or Scottish, and because, you know, it's a really strong heritage, and this, the knot work, you know, the mystery of the knots, and, you know, and that kind of thing. It's like this big draw, and I'm like, hey, wait, I'm Irish, you know. I don't have to wish it, because I, you know, I get to live it. And
I think, too, the older you get, the more important that stuff becomes, which, right. I think at this time in our life is why, because, you know, in college you're thinking more about partying and friends and stuff, and mm-hmm. But
I mean, your name is so, Fitzgerald is so obviously Irish. And then you go, we went to the Scottish Irish Festival last summer, which was the first year of it. And the gentleman from the gathering, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, but he was selling the tickets to the...
Treloc.
Yes, yeah, thank
Treloc,
you.
Yeah.
And he... And as soon as Jeff wrote down his name, he's like, oh, Mr. Fitzgerald. And he spent, and every time we saw him, he'd greet him and he kept talking about his last name. And it just makes you feel.
Yeah. And it, I think it's with the capital G in Fitzgerald. It's like, I have to say that, correct it 10 zillion
every time,
times.
Almost.
People will write my name on it. Like, oh, it's a capital G. And they're like.
And then they're like, oh, is it two separate words?
Is it two words? It's like, no, it's just, I go, it's like McDonald's. It's one word, you know, it's just. And so I just having to correct it and say it over and over and over and over and over. And it just, I think now it's, and one of the other things that we do, we're not having kids. And so I want to, you know, I can't have kids. I was born sterile. And so I'm like the last male Fitzgerald, you know, with the last name Fitzgerald. My sister's got two boys. And so they can kind of carry down that line. But it's just this feeling of I want to know everything I can because I don't have any sons to pass it down to. You know, it's just like...
That's just interesting, too. The two of us who aren't going to have kids are the most interested in our family ancestry in all of mm-hmm. our families.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Just
yeah, I'm mm-hmm. just really drawn to it, and I just love the history, and I've read a lot about, like, the Vikings, and, I mean, the Vikings landed on Ireland and... you know, killed half the people on there and then took over and lived there for a long time. So even the people with the Irish heritage have a little bit of Norwegian in them, mm-hmm. too.
Doesn't everybody?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So, which is really interesting.
I think part of it is that we use it to define ourselves, too, because neither one of us get along with our families all that much sometimes because we were, like, I was called the black sheep, and I think, you know, we were both different than our families, and I think part of that draw then is maybe trying to define ourselves a little bit, you know, when you're told by your family that you're different and you feel different, I think maybe you just try to define yourself by finding out what you can about your family, which is, I think we both felt in certain respects when we were looking this up, like, okay, now I know why I feel this way, now mm-hmm. I know why this is interesting to me, and it made us feel better.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys partake in any other traditions? Like, have you learned Irish dance? Have you played music or any?
We are hoping to, once I started using the Gaelic, like in my books and stuff, and we started looking it up, and I found out the Irish Studies program has the language, I'm hoping to start taking that so I can know the pronunciation for my books. Mm-hmm. We don't play the Irish music, but we don't play instruments, but we listen to it a lot. We, you know, once we started discovering, like, the Renaissance fairs, once we started hearing some of the music and went to, on rerun, there was groups like the Elders that play there, and their music is fantastic.
Andrakis.
And when we first saw their, was it Andrakis that had the dancers with them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was just... You know, I mean, I think we'd seen, you know, Lord of the Dance, but mm-hmm. to see it in person is completely different. And yeah. it's just, I would love to learn how to Irish dance, but it looks hard.
Yeah.
And, you know.
I took classes. If I can do it, you can.
Oh, did you? Oh, yeah. It just looks amazing to me. And at one of, you know, at some of the Renaissance fairs we went to in Oregon when we first started going, there was a, she looked like she was maybe 14-year-old girl playing the fiddle and dancing at the same time, and ooh, and she was extremely talented. And you look mm-hmm. at that and you just think, and you're hooked.
Yeah.
I think you're hooked.
I don't mm-hmm. think I have the musical background to play. I have more of an artistic background, but the Irish music is like really calming to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I do wildlife drawings, and so when I'm drawing, I'll put that on. I'll play mm-hmm. any Irish music, and it just...
Well, and if we have parties or people
so
over,
better.
Often we'll put it'll be an Irish CD that we put on
mm-hmm.
And play low, and just because it's, the music is just amazing.
Yeah.
It just makes me want to go to Ireland.
Mm.
Yeah.
So both of you have mentioned that you are artists.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And you, Chrissy, mentioned that you are writing, or that you have written in the past as well, using the... the Gaelic language and Gaelic names. And
I do.
And that's, is that something that you did before you found this interest, or is
well, you know, I'm a big fantasy fiction fan, and of course I read Lord of the Rings and the Chronicles of Narnia and stuff, but Lord of the Rings was fascinating to me because he, the author, J.R.R. Tolkien, created his own language, and there are language classes taught at universities based on it. And you know, it's very, if you look at the language, it is a little bit, it looks a little Celtic based, because the Gaelic language is probably one of the more beautiful languages out there. And I took German in high school, and which is one of the least beautiful languages out there. And so when I started reading Gaelic and hearing it, I mean, just to hear somebody with an Irish accent, I mean, you just want them to keep talking. Mm-hmm. And so looking at the Gaelic language, and I found a couple of places online, which thankfully found them, that will translate entire phrases for you. And so once you do that and you see it, even just seeing it written, even if you can't pronounce it, it's just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think when I started, you know, looking into fantasy fiction writing, because originally I think I've always written fiction and poetry. Mm-hmm. It just was, to me, there was an appeal of just not even how it sounds, but how it looks. I mean, mm-hmm. both of it, if you can learn how to pronounce it, because mm-hmm. it looks nothing like it sounds.
Yes.
Yeah. It just, there's so
many
letters.
I'm in my fourth semester of Irish.
Oh, so. Are you? Oh, yeah. That's great. And that's what I hope to do, is take some, because it's just such a beautiful language.
But it is, you're right, it does not sound
at all like it looks.
Like it looks.
There are so many hidden letters. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. and it sounds good.
Mm-hmm. And you do wildlife drawings and pen, mm-hmm. is pen and ink?
Pencil. I've been doing art my whole life, and I think that was an avenue for me to take when I was younger, when I was upset and the stress of, you know, divorced parents and all that kind of stuff, is that I really like fell into art at early, like I can remember doing drawings like third, fourth grade.
He's very good.
And then, and when I got into seventh grade, I got moved into a gifted arts program. And then high school, I got put in the gifted arts again. And so I've done a lot of different, like, mediums, like oils and acrylic and watercolor paints. And I've done some sculpture and woodworking. I do a little bit of furniture, but mostly it's pencil drawings of wildlife, and I do have, we saved out some drawings to show you today.
His great-grandfather, Harold Belden, is an incredibly gifted oil painter, does kind of run in the family.
Yeah, and Harold was, he, you know, I think it's just the Fitzgerald line, is just work, 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 work. You just, that's all you do, you work until you, either you work till you die, or you work till you can retire. And so
Brooks was forced to retire.
Yeah.
He wanted to keep working.
Right. He was forced to retire at 84.
Oh,
and he was very upset.
He wanted to keep working.
So he, Harold had a lot of artistic talent. He didn't start oil painting until he retired in his mid-60s. And it turned out that he probably could have been a professional painter. And we have, luckily, we've got some of his oil paintings. And they're just awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just amazing.
Oh,
work.
And drawings. We did finally get some of his drawings.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's amazing.
And back in those days, or even in these days, it's like being an artist doesn't feed a family very well. And so I think that was just a pastime. And so you can see the artwork that Harold and Brooks did, like in high school and college.
That's right, Brooks did.
Which is just amazing. And then they work, you know, some other job for the rest of their life, and then they never get back into it again, except for Harold did a little bit, and Brooks never got back into it.
But he did become a photographer and a videographer. He had movies shown in the theaters.
Yeah, he made movies, like 8mm, that was shown, like, in movie theaters.
Wow.
So, of life in the outdoors, basically. So,
interesting.
Brooks made movies on 8mm camera in the Beartooth mountain range. And so he had a friend of his named Milt, who was a dyed-in-the-wool mountain man. It's like Milt he in the winters he would live in this crappy little trailer, and then in the summers, and I don't even know what Milt did for work, but in the summers or he would just move into the Beartooths and just live like a mountain man. And so my grandfather and he hooked up, and I don't know the story of how they found each other, but Brooks would make movies out in the woods, and so he made like Land of the Pink Snow, and
that had like big movie premieres and posters and were nationally known, and
yeah, and so really cool stuff. And my dad and his younger brother Bob would be in the movies
and
also, and they kind of have stories, you know, they try to do stories. And yeah, and my grandpa's wife, my grandmother, would be in the movies. And
where are these? Who has these movies?
We have
some of them.
My dad's got copies. They're all on VHS now, mm-hmm. and so we need to get them transferred to like DVD or on the computer chip, or I don't know. We need to try to preserve them, you know, because they are really cool to watch. Because you get to see what the Beartooth Mountain Range looked like in 1955.
Wow.
You know, and up there, there were no trails. It's like all the trails that they walked on are, you know, with their horse strings, was all game trails.
Unreal.
It's like Brooks became this, you know, he came from New Jersey and his family from Ireland, and he never talked about it, but he came to Montana. He took thousands of pictures of Montana. He did all this videography of Montana, and then he bought 100 acres in Montana that he spent his whole life working for. And it just, Montana was just this huge, important thing to him.
Yeah, it was a huge draw for him.
Very interesting. So you just kind of came across your skills drawing on your own then.
Right. And it was natural, like the drawing. Like I never had any problems, you know, drawing anything or doing artwork, and I can be like, I don't know, maybe other artists feel like this, but when I start a project or I think about something I want to do, I can see it in my mind of what it's going to look like when it's finished. And like, I built these two, I know that you can't see them, but I built these two kind of baker's racks out of birch and willow, and I envisioned this exactly before I started to build it. And so I didn't need to make a drawing of it, because I just could just build it as I went. And so, and everything turned out pretty much exactly like I thought it would.
Wow. He's very thorough though.
Yeah, and I'm really
perfectionist.
I'm a perfectionist, which can be a curse as well, but but I kind of got into like, I did some woodworking, and I've done some wood carving and relief work, and I've made coat racks, and there's a couple over there, like trout and black bears and grizzlies. Yeah. And I make those, and I've been selling them on and off. But I think the pencil drawings is what I'm really drawn to, and I really enjoy drawing wildlife. And I would when I got done with high school and got into college, I either wanted to go into art or be a fish biologist. That was the only two things. And you know, everybody was like, oh, both of those, you're never going to make any money at it. You know, it doesn't pay well. It's hard to get into. And I was like, you know, I don't care. It's either art or biology. And I thought, well, if I become an artist, you know, I'm going to be broke and then have nothing on the side. But then if I could get into biology, I can always do art on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I ended up getting into. And I took some art classes in college and then discovered I didn't have enough time, because in college they want you to spend 10 hours, you know, a day practically on doing drawings and stuff, and I didn't have the time.
Right.
And so through part of college I got out of it a little bit, and then I started drawing on and off after college, and now I'm trying to get back into it, and I really want to make prints and sell them. And I think my
You've sold some.
Yeah, I've been commissioned for some drawings, and and I really enjoy it, and that's kind of where my focus is now, is getting back into that.
And you, with your poetry that you had mentioned, that's something you've always done.
We've, you know, we have a we have a gazillion hobbies. Yeah. We are never, you know, I've also done art. I was in gifted arts programs in high school, watercolor and scratchboard. My mom called them scratch and sniff boards. Scratchboard and pencil drawings as well, because in costume design I had to learn how to draw people. So he's really good at animals and I'm really good at people, just because, like, in graduate school I had to take art classes, but I also on the side took a watercolor class, because you have to watercolor your designs, and then I also took a figure drawing class where, you know, they have models, and learned how to get really good at that. And then I also sew, and that became a huge hobby for me. I make quilts and I make costumes, and after graduate school I got into Renaissance costumes, and that was huge for me, and I was going to actually sell those because I love going to Renaissance fairs and I love making big Renaissance costumes. I have sold costumes over the years. And I make our home stuff, like I make our curtains, which you can't see because we're moving, but I make like the curtains and I make the throw pillows and I make our bed covers and, you know, all that stuff, just cause I like to do it. I love to sew. And, but writing I also do. And, you know, because I've been laid off and there's not a lot of work around here, I thought, well, I'll give it a shot and see. I could sell my costumes, but writing is free. And costumes, I have to have money to buy the supplies. Mm-hmm. And so I found that, because I had an English major, and in graduate school you had to write, and you know, I've done poetry over the years. Poetry's a lot harder to get into. Right. They get rejected a lot more. I have had a poem published in an anthology, but writing articles on stuff I know, like the costumes, and the book that I'm writing has to do with Renaissance fairs. And so, you know, writing about what you know is a lot better. And so we just have so many hobbies that there's always something to do. We never have enough time in the day.
Work gets in the way of our hobbies. Yes. Yep. Dang it.
I'll ask you both this question. What are the most striking changes in your life so far, the greatest moments of joy and sorrow?
Like our whole life? I guess the moments of joy is finding Christy and getting married. It was probably the biggest one. Just because I struggled with girls my whole life, and in high school, and I mean, I have this genetic condition where it's called Klinefelter syndrome, and so it's my body doesn't produce testosterone, which means I never hit puberty, you know, until somebody discovered it. So I was basically the size of a 10-year-old until I was 17. And so the thing with Klinefelters is your body doesn't generate testosterone, and so your muscle doesn't grow, and you don't hit that puberty stage at 12 where things are changing and stuff. And I kept growing, but I didn't put on any weight. And so when I was 16, my sophomore year of high school, I grew 6 inches in 9 months, but I didn't gain any weight.
Oh my goodness.
So when I got my driver's license, I was like 5'10", and I weighed 82 pounds.
Oh my word.
And so junior high and high school was just brutal. I mean, I was the kid that got bullied, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's why art was such a draw for me, is that I could go and hide. Because, you know, the bullies, they don't go into the art department. So...
But when they discovered it, he takes synthetic testosterone, and so he developed. By the time I met him, he was developing, but he was little. But he has the best heart of anybody I know, and
it was just hard. And so high school was just I hated high school. I think my joyous times in high school were getting to go to art class for 3 hours a day. You know, that was like, that was the best, because I didn't want to go home. You know, I didn't want to go to my crappy job where I was cooking seven hours, you know, a night. When I got to college, when I was 17, my spring of my junior year, I went to my dad's doctor because I was really sick. My regular doctor couldn't get me in. And he looked at me, like I walked into his office and he took one look at me and he's like, I'll be right back. And I was like, you know, what's going on? And he was an internal medicine doctor, and he identified what I had like that.
Just by looking at him. And it's very rare. People now still don't even know.
Yeah. And so he got on the phone to his friend, John Opitz, who was a geneticist at the Mayo Clinic. And he's like, you are not going to believe what I have in my office right now. And he didn't close the door, and I'm sitting in his office like,
going, what's wrong?
What the hell is going on? And then I'm just scared to death. And he comes back in. He's like, I'm really excited. And he's like, I think you have Klinefelter syndrome, but I got my friend coming down. And so then 2 days later, Dr. Opitz comes down, and he actually moved to Helena. And he worked at the Mayo Clinic. And I'm like, oh, my God, what do I have? And it turns out this Klinefelter syndrome, it's really uncommon. People don't see it very often. And my doctor, or my dad's doctor, Dr. McAvoy, was awesome about it. And they treated me really well.
The thing is it should be identified at birth or when they're toddlers. So that he got caught so late was
very rare. Because they take like x-rays, and like they took an x-ray of my hand for bone growth. And I had the bone growth of my body was of a 12-year-old, even though I was 17, almost 18. And so at that time, the only way to get the testosterone was through injections. And so it was like for like every week, so they're basically trying to get me caught up to where I'm supposed to be. Yeah. So they're just like shooting in testosterone, was like every week, just going. And so talk about a growth spurt between, like within 3 months, I think I swear to God could see my calves getting bigger. It's like I gained like 40 pounds in 3 months of muscle that should have happened prior to that.
Gosh.
So it's like this crazy, you know, crazy fast growth. But I still, you know, I was still growing. And when I graduated high school, I was 6 feet. And then I grew 4 inches in college. Wow. And still, I've always been really thin. And my dad was really skinny, you know, and my grandpa was skinny. And on my mom's side, they were skinny, so.
So is this Klinefelter's? Is that what you
Klinefelter's syndrome.
Klinefelter's. Is that a genetic? Does that pass down in families? Or?
It doesn't pass down. It is genetic, but it's not hereditary.
They don't know why it happens.
And it's where the chromosomes, like women are XX, men are XY, and Klinefelter's is XXY. And so the mother gives both X's, and then the father gives a Y. And so it's like a triploid chromosome. And so, and that's always sterile.
And it's not genetic. They just don't know why it happens.
Yeah.
But he had to give himself shots every 2 weeks up until 5 years ago.
Yeah, so I learned, before I went to college, I learned to give the shots myself. And it's no different than, like, you know, people who are diabetic have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But these needles were like an inch long, and it was just like alternating thighs every 2 weeks, you know. Mm. And there's sometimes it was really a real struggle, because you can't shoot it into a blood vessel because it's thick. It's like honey. And so if that goes into a blood vessel and hits your heart, you're dead, you know. So you have to miss the blood vessels. It has to go right into muscle tissue. I struggled with doctors. Testosterone is illegal. I mean, that's what the athletes do.
Occasionally we'd have a pharmacy that would give us problems because they thought that we were trying to get it. And it's not, the kind that he got was not illegal, but occasionally you'd have a pharmacy that would make a big deal out of it, and he had to have it.
Yeah. So that really dictated a lot on where we could live, what
doctors,
jobs I could take.
How close we could be to hospitals and doctors.
Because it's like you can't, like when we moved to Oregon and lived up in the middle of the forest, I was really nervous.
You can't have an emergency up there. It was 45 minutes to the nearest.
It's just like trying to find, because before we move anywhere, we have to make sure there's the right doctors are in place, you know, I can get the testosterone, things like that. So that really dictated that we couldn't just be free as a bird and move wherever we wanted.
Right.
It really had to be structured. And so it was taking a huge risk going to Oregon
but it was the best
to live in the forest, because I'm like, you know, I can't, if I missed a shot, it would be, it just meant deep depression because
the testosterone level.
Yeah. So you're on a, like this, you know, peak trough type of thing. And so when I'd give the shot for like the first 4 or 5 days, I'd be like on top of the world, like, you know, euphoric. And then I kind of go through this middle ground for a couple of days. And then the last 3 or 4 days was like a deep depression. And as it was wearing off, and so then I'd give a shot and it's like, oh yay, you know, and I go down and then at the end it's like, oh my god, I want to die. And so it was like this for 17 years, every 2 weeks.
And so then did you reach a point where you don't have to do that anymore?
Yes, luckily. Thank god somebody invented testosterone gel.
It's, well, they had a patch, but it wasn't right. it wasn't real regular. There were problems with it.
Yeah, they had the medicine in a patch that you'd stick on your leg or your arm or something. But what happens is the patch is on for a couple days and it sucks all the moisture out of the skin as it's delivering the medicine. And so when you peel the patch off, you've got like a big sore.
Oh.
And then
and sometimes it has, if it doesn't make all the connection, it doesn't work.
It was miserable. And so I tried that for a few months and it was just not happening. And then when we moved to Montana, I ended up finding an endocrinologist in Missoula, you know, a specialist. And she said, she's like, oh, they make an androgel. It's a gel. Then you just squirt it on your hands and it's every day. And so this is like the miracle drug because I put it on every morning on my chest and it's like every day. You know, I still go through little bits of depression and stuff, and I have to be on medication for that because of, it's just part of Klinefelter's is depression, so I have to be on antidepressants. Mm-hmm. But I put this gel on every morning, and it's now my life is finally regulated. But for, you know, for so long, for like the first 17 years, it was really depressing and scrawny and getting beat up and stuff. And then the next 17 is just like this peak trough of euphoria and depression, and so finally it's regulated. I'm like, oh.
Thank goodness.
Wow. So.
So it's been kind of a struggle. Financially too, because of, you know, Fish and Wildlife did not have benefits and theater doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
So we, you know, if we ended up in an emergency room, that was $600 out of our own pocket, or, you know, he inherited bad teeth. And so that was a $3,000 dental visit once. And so we've spent most of our life paying stuff off. We don't own a house. We may never. It's just that's one of those things.
But our saying is always that we're the happiest poor people we know.
Right.
And you're in good company.
I know. And that's so true. And
you know, it really is. And that.
And I have no problem that he can't have kids. When I met him, I thought maybe I would have kids. But, you know, I grew up in a really bad family situation, and except for my grandfather. And when I met him, my mom was like, why would you marry someone that can't have kids? And I thought, why would I punish him for that? You know, that would be silly. And plus, you can adopt if you want. But the more we were together, the more I didn't care. I just and we have so much fun together. And we've been together now for almost 22 years. And I think that I can't imagine having somebody else now, I guess, besides our pets, because we just have a lot of fun. And I think any time that I have with him has been probably my best times.
Yeah.
And my.
So kind of like on your question on the joys and sorrows, I think the joy was Christine and I finding each other, and the sorrows were the dealing with the Klinefelters, and, you know, and of course, like the loss of grandparents, you know, passing. And
that's probably the worst.
Grandmother and the Fitzgerald grandparents.
We were both really close to our grandparents, and we lucked out because both of us were the closest of the grandkids, which didn't always work very well with the other family because they'd get upset. They'd get jealous, I think, sometimes. But, you know, my great-grandmother and my grandfather and I were very, very close. And he and I got to be really close to his grandparents that lived in Big Timber, and we lived in Bozeman because it was 45 minutes away and we could go every weekend. So we were very close to our grandparents, and when they died, that was probably the worst thing that's ever happened, I know, to me, was losing them.
Yeah.
Well, we'll finish it up today by, I'm just going to ask you both to answer this question separately. And if you were to write the history of the Irish in Montana, what would you include for future generations?
That's a hard one.
I think that the Irish pride is very much alive, especially in Butte. And I think that's pretty cool. Like not only the fact that they have St. Patrick's Day in Butte, but the Henri Ross celebration that they do every year. And then they have, when you go down there, it's such a fierce Irish pride. And I hope they continue to do that. I think that's really neat. And I think that even though it's getting the Irish blood, you know, disperses like everything. And especially, you know, he's half Norwegian, but he's only, you know, like a quarter Irish. The fact that people have so much pride in the Irish part of their ancestry says a lot, I think. And I hope that people will continue to find that stuff. Not knowing about Macmillan is sad to me. And I hope that people will, especially families, parents, grandparents, I hope they will pass their ancestry knowledge down to their kids, because even if they don't seem like they want to know, eventually they will want to know. And you know, I don't have kids, but I have nieces, and I think they'll want to know who their ancestors are. And if you can travel, like we hope to do someday, and go to the, you know, the country that your forefathers came from, what a great journey to make. And I think that I don't care how dispersed it gets, I think that people will always have some sort of pride for the heritage that they have.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I agree with a lot of that. And I was just thinking, I just lost my train of thought a little bit.
Later
but
too?
No, well, no, but when I was growing up, Butte was the scariest high school because those guys, they were very good at sports, but that Irish pride scared the crap out of every high school that had to go there to play games. And so there was some fights here and there and stuff, but it's like the whole city has got this great pride, and which is
when it comes out at gatherings, it's amazing.
Pretty remarkable. And I think I'd like to see, it seems like Montana in the last decade or so is getting better about celebrating the Irish Scottish
and spreading it out beyond Butte. Like we have the Irish Scottish Festival in Hamilton now. They have a Celtic festival in Missoula now. Not just having it in Butte and spreading it out is really cool.
But it wasn't like the Dragon Pipe Band in Missoula has been there for years, and I've never heard of it.
Until the Scottish Irish Festival.
Right, and it's like, it's not, maybe they're advertising it in places where I don't see, but there's a lot of people that like pipe bands and Irish music, but it seems like the advertising isn't quite there yet to reach out to everybody. Mm-hmm. But people that are part of, I think, Irish clubs or, you know, on newsletters and stuff, they hear about it and they go, but it's like,
sharing the culture.
Yeah,
more
sharing
wide,
it is
worldwide. Like taking the Irish dancing lessons, I think that it would be amazing if they offered it in different places, not just
satellite
Butte, but Hamilton and, you know, Great Falls, and, you know, just having a chance to, even if it was people like a traveling group that was here for a one night class or something, how cool would it be to see that?
But yeah, I think it's like if people can just, like, family secrets just kill people's heritages and learning that information. And, you know, we've spent months on ancestry.com trying to trace, you know, my Irish side of the family and in preparation for this interview, and then just for personal. And then 2 days ago, my dad mails me stuff he's had for years, and it's just like, holy smokes, I just learned more now than I did on 5 months on the internet.
Which he didn't even tell us he had, and we've been talking to him for months.
It's like, oh, you're pulling your hair out.
Right.
So, I don't know.
I don't think people should be embarrassed either. And I think that's partly the problem with some of this family secrets is that people get embarrassed of their heritage, and, you know, we don't understand what it was like to live back then. But the fact is in our generation, we don't care. I wouldn't be embarrassed at all about my heritage. When I found out I was Native American, I thought, well, that's really cool. And some people get really embarrassed about some of that stuff, and I just think that's who you are.
Yeah.
So. Okay, well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.